I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. This time, we're tracking down the public meaning of a newish novel with its author. Joseph O'Neill wrote Netherland, the book we know President Obama has been reading this spring. His story centers on the cult of cricket that's hidden in plain sight on New York playing fields ever since 9/11. Cricket, of all things, the bat and ball game we barely know, the old British imperial forerunner of baseball, dominated now by Indians, Pakistanis, South Africans, Australians, and West Indians who abound in the new New York. I make two guesses here, that Barack Obama knows almost as little about the game of cricket as I do, which is zero, and further, much more interesting, that he has found in Joseph O'Neill's Cricket in New York novel a sort of founding text for this turnabout era, this reconciling moment we seem to have entered, this age of Obama, in which a game might just have giant implications. Joseph O'Neill, it is such a thrill, if I may say, to meet the author of Netherland. You know, you mentioned the game of cricket, and you can hear, as they say, radios turning out all over America. But I want to stare that challenge down, not for the game of cricket, which I've never seen and don't understand, but for the aura around the game and for the writer that we love behind it, C.L.R. James. James casts a huge glow of meaning around cricket, and so does the fascinating character in your book, Chuck Ramkissoon. I wish you'd just read one of those sections in which this Trinidadian in New York, Chuck Ramkissoon, builds a kind of whole system, political fantasy, a human fantasy around his game.
Yes. I should just explain before I read this that Chuck's dream is to build a cricket stadium in New York City, and he's explaining to the narrator of the novel, a Dutchman called Hans, or as they would say in Holland, Hans, what he's up to. And it starts, Chuck paused and adjusted his Yankees cap. "I have a question for you." "Fire away," I said. "How many West Indians would you say lived in the New York area? English-speaking West Indians now. I'm not talking about Haitians and Dominicans and what have you." I told him I had no idea. "Well, let me enlighten you," Chuck said, waving to the frozen cop who guarded the battery tunnel turnoff. "According to the 2000 census, 500,000. You can safely add 50%. So we're talking about 750,000, maybe even a million, and growing. We had 60% growth in the 1990s alone, and by the way, West Indians have a better socioeconomic profile than Hispanics, and a way better one than African Americans. But that's not the exciting part. The Indian," he banged a hand against the wheel, "population in NYC has grown by 81% in the last 10 years. The Pakistani," another bang, "numbers have gone up by 150%, and the Bangladeshis, wait for it, 500%. In New Jersey, they're overrun with South Asians. Fort Lee, Jersey City, Hoboken, Secaucus, Hackensack, Englewood. Navratri celebrations in these towns can bring out 20,000 people. It's the same in New Brunswick, Edison, Metuchen. I'm telling you, I've done the research, I've got all the numbers, and if you think they're coming to mop floors and drive taxis, you're wrong. They're coming to make real money. High-tech, pharmaceuticals, electronics, healthcare. There's almost 500,000 South Asians in New York alone. Have you ever visited the newcomer school in Astoria? All the kids are from Pakistan. You know what they do in their spare time, these kids? They play cricket. They play at Dutch Kills Playground over by PS112. They play in vacant lots. They play in schoolyards up and down Queens and Brooklyn. Just down the block from me at PS139, you see boys and girls with cricket bats, even in the snow. If I took you there now, I could show you the wicket they've drawn on the wall." He grinned. "You see where I'm going with this." "You want to build a cricket stadium," I said. I made no attempt to hide my amusement. "That's right," Chuck said, "but not at Pier 40 in Manhattan. That was my first decision. There's no way they're going to let a bunch of black guys take over prime Manhattan real estate." "Hate the word stadium, by the way," Chuck said importantly. We were exiting the yellow gloom of the battery tunnel, whose old tiled walls invariably put me in mind of a urinal. "Stadium spells trouble. Just ask Mike Bloomberg. I'm talking about an arena. a sports arena for the greatest cricket teams in the world, 12 exhibition matches every summer watched by 8,000 spectators at $50 a pop. I'm talking about advertising. I'm talking about year-round consumption of food and drink in the bar restaurant. You're going to have a clubhouse, 2,000 members at $1,000 a year, plus initiation fee, tennis, squash, 10-pin bowling, indoor facilities, a gymnasium, a swimming pool, a sports bar, something for everyone. But at the centre of it, cricket. The only true cricket club in the country, the New York Cricket Club. "That's great," I said. Chuck burst out laughing. "I know what you're thinking. I'm out of my mind. But you haven't heard the kicker." He looked at me. "Ready? Global TV rights. A game between India and Pakistan in New York City, in a state-of-the-art arena, with Liberty Tower in the background. Can you imagine the panning shots?" Chuck said almost furiously, "We're thinking a TV and internet viewership of 70 million in India alone. 70 million. Do you have any idea how much money this would bring in? Coca-Cola, Nike, they're all desperate to get at the South Asian market. We figure we'd break even in 3, at most 4 years. And after that..." High on the Gowanus Expressway now, he waved an arm at the cold, bright bay and the mainland beyond. Lights had started shining in Elizabeth and in the Bayonne Heights. "It's an impossible idea, right? But I'm convinced it will work. Totally convinced. You know what my motto is?" "I didn't think people had mottos anymore," I said. "Think fantastic," Chuck said. "My motto is, think fantastic."
Part of the news of your book, Netherland, was this open secret in New York of hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if not more than a million, West Indians and South Asians living in New York, and thousands of them playing cricket every weekend. For Chuck Ramkissoon, there's a get-rich-quick scheme maybe here, but there are all sorts of other meanings in this game. Count the ways.
Well, I mean, you're never sure with this guy, Chuck, whether he's an opportunistic idealist or an actual idealist. But one of the theories he has is that Americans will never, America will never reach its, fulfill its actual, its true destiny unless it plays cricket, unless it comes to understand this game. You know, the theory being that if you can't understand cricket, how are you going to understand the rest of the world? How are you going to understand Pakistan, for example? Mm. And so he sees it as his mission to introduce the game to Americans, and not only in order to make a quick buck, but in order to get them to play the game, to think about the game, and thereby think, you know, fantastic, as it were.
But what's the meaning? To him, to you, to any of us?
Well, I mean, you know, cricket is a... The meaning of cricket will depend on the situation, but one meaning which I was certainly conscious of when I started writing about it was that cricket is, you know, represents a boundary of American vision. Mm. One character in the book says Americans... You know, can only see so far. Can only understand so much, and the limit is cricket. That's where their vision of the world, their understanding of the world, grinds to a halt. And so there's that meaning. In addition to that, like all sports, which are played by men beyond a certain age, cricket is. An activity that is connected to memory, to childhood, mm. to summer, to recurrence, and to the strange kind of emotional and almost spiritual landscape that men, by and large, secretly carry around inside them.
It fascinates me, though the game doesn't interest me at all, it fascinates me because about 10 years ago, I read what stays at number 36 on the Sports Illustrated all-time greatest sports books, mm-hmm. a kind of autobiography in terms of cricket by a man named C.L.R. James. The book is called Beyond a Boundary, and it's one of the 10 books I'd take to a desert island, and it's full of meaning. All the more on the news that President Obama is reading your book, mm-hmm. Netherland, which is a kind of child, as Chuck Graham Cassoon is a child of C.L.R. James. So I'd love to spend what time we have just kind of picking this thing mm-hmm. apart. Can I throw out a few things that I think C.L.R. James mm-hmm. Believed fervently? For one thing, C.L.R. James was a black Trinidadian, completely unlike V.S. Naipaul in the sense that he was of the African persuasion, a pan-African, an enthusiastic black man of rabid anti-colonial, anti-imperial, who embraced the British culture too. He embraced cricket above all, and he embraced Thackeray and Dickens and this sort of thing. But he found in cricket a way of balancing somehow all the emotions around colonialism and imperialism, white power, and black virtuosity. All of these things somehow came together in the game. Is that fair? Is that a? I mean, what's your view on that slice?
Well, I mean, just a bit of background for those who have not yet read this wonderful book. Cricket is played in Trinidad and was introduced to the island, of course, by the British imperial project. And when C.L.R. James, as a black man, came to play at all the clubs of Trinidad, the cricket clubs, were their membership accorded to various hues of skin color.
Yes.
And he's very and James is very witty about this, and in fact very and self critical, because he joined a club. He was a quite black man, and he joined a club where the men were not quite as black as he was. And as a result, he rather shamefully acknowledges in this book that he'd felt that he'd sort of somehow sort of joined the club that sort of elevated him above his natural station, and he took a false pride in that. But of course, as he matured to become a great Marxist philosopher, essentially, he tried to make sense of this paradoxical obsession he had with this sport, which he loved on a very practical, nitty-gritty level. He loved all aspects of it. But he was strangely wedded to the idea of fair play, which was certainly at that time very connected to cricket. And so on the one hand, you have this guy who is a subversive of the first order. And as you rightly point out, he's also sees enormous value in certain conventions embodied by the sport of cricket. And oddly enough, although it's not that odd, because he's essentially an economic thinker, and his ideas of social justice have to do with class and with economics rather than racial politics, he takes a very sort of unemotional approach to the question of race and cricket. And in fact, he remembers his own cricketing youth as being tinged by racism, obviously. But he said, it sort of stiffened us up. And he sort of disposes of that issue almost impatiently, because he has larger fish to fry. He refuses to be circumscribed by the narratives of racial injustice, and instead feels entitled to participate in a kind of global discussion about justice and politics and economics. And I think that for him, his practical experience of playing cricket and of the moral demands made on him and of what he learnt from that experience, I think made him feel that this was a very valuable instrument in any political project. And not just an instrument, he actually felt, and this is where he may lose American readers, he actually felt that cricket was an end unto itself as well.
Yes. On the matter of race, it seems to me, James, in sum, sees cricket as a wide enough frame to bring a sort of British country tradition into a world where, as it turns out, Caribbean virtuosity, athleticism, invention, imagination can make its own enormously distinctive contribution. And that is a metaphor of a kind of multi or transnational world. I think is the point, is it not?
Well, I mean, you know, as with CL, I think there are lots of points here. I mean, one point for him specifically was that, you know, if you were one of the members of the colonized races in Trinidad, and there were two, and Trinidad is an island divided into an African population and a South Asian population, almost 50-50, you were allowed very few forms of self-expression, and one of those was cricket. It was the one of the arenas where certain hierarchies were abolished, and a lot of sports have that in common. And he thought that that was a great thing, you know, where people could have access to their souls, in a way, on the cricket field, in a way that they couldn't have outside the cricket field.
Yeah.
And also the trajectory of Trinidad in particular towards independence was, you know, went hand in hand with the West Indies cricket team gradually becoming a team which reflected the West Indian population and not the population of the colonists. But I think he also felt that, quite separately from those local things, that, you know, why he took it as a given. He said, "Well, this is a, you know, cricket is like art. It's a wonderful thing, and why should we diminish ourselves? We being the colonized peoples in this case, by persisting to kind of see it as being owned by the colonizer.
Yes.
Why can't we own the sport? So what if they made it up? And are we not just as entitled to the particular bliss and gratifications that this sport offers? And that is quite a big an important statement to make. It's a way of throwing off colonial, categories of the world, and it's a way of laying claim to, what the world has to offer, and we see now in the way that cricket is now organized around the world that in fact India is the main power in cricket, and will undoubtedly come to. And will remain in that position for many years. And the old seat of power in London is not what it was.
So it's a game that allows the tables to be turned. There's something of fairness about
it. Yes, exactly.
Okay. There's another big point that C.L.R. James celebrates about cricket, that it has a morality almost built into it, certainly the way the British gave it. These clichés like, you know, straight bat, or it's not cricket.
Yeah.
He sees as a kind of code, a universal code of fair play.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's a historical irony that that code is essentially gone now. I mean, it's the game of cricket.
Even in cricket?
Oh, yeah. Hmm. The game of cricket is now fantastically commercialized, so much money at stake, and there are so many passions at stake. That it's gone the way of most sports, which is to say, morally neutral, and that the element of fair play and good sportsmanship is a bonus rather than an integral part of the game. I mean, I think golf is pretty much the only game now which places kind of demands on the conscience of its players.
And yet, C.L.R. James surely would say that there are implications way beyond the sport itself. What he learned in schoolboy cricket was you don't cheat, you don't have a beef with the umpire, you don't complain, you don't make excuses, and that surely applies to more than just the playing field.
It does, but, you know, how do you promulgate those values? One way is by playing cricket, but that doesn't actually work. Playing cricket doesn't make you into a better person.
He thought it did.
He thought it did, but the way it's turned out, that's not necessarily the case.
Chuck Ramkusoon, in your novel, surely thought it would make a better New York, a better America, a better world?
Well, I think, you know, there's an element of this. Yeah, he certainly thinks that. Now, the thing is, of course, we have to remember that these values are actually, you know, present in almost all sports. And you know, to a greater or lesser degree. Do you remember just recently when the Cavaliers lost, and there was a big hoo-ha in the papers that LeBron James would sure. not congratulate the victors, and after the game in the playoffs, and people were puzzled by this, and the fact that they were puzzled and it was a song and dance suggests to me that there are basic notions of kind of sportsmanship are alive and well in all kinds of sports. But what was really odd was that he was, he actually maintained. He said, if I've lost, I've lost, and I'm in no mood to sort of thank anybody for that. And he equated that sort of attitude with, being a real competitor. Whereas, I think, older and wiser basketball players would undoubtedly tell you, actually, that isn't, that isn't the hallmark of a great player.
We love that picture of the hockey teams, filing past each other and shaking hands. We also love the tradition of, nice guys finish last.
Yeah. But, in sports like hockey and rugby, you have to have those traditions, particularly in rugby, because you're involved in such intense physical combat for 80 minutes in rugby that unless you sort of kind of congratulate each other at the end, unless you sort of all got into the shower together and slapped each other on the back and sing songs and sort of get drunk together, whatever rugby players do after the game, you would, you wouldn't actually be able to play your game because it would degenerate into simple war. So there is this kind of, these games are ruled not only by the kind of rules that apply on the playing field, they're also governed by a kind of social rules. And then this is the interesting thing from the C.L.R. James point of view is, well, what are those social rules and are they applicable to society at large? And, why is it that sports is one of these great reservoirs of civility? It's the paradox. These are such competitive activities, and yet there is this kind of penumbrum of civility that surrounds practically every sport.
There's another element in the James and Ramkissoon embrace of cricket just as a game, the importance of games. James, in Beyond a Boundary, says at some point, I believe and hope to prove that cricket and football were the greatest cultural influences on 19th century Britain, leading far behind Tennyson's poems, Beardsley's drawings, and concerts at the Philharmonic Society. He loves games for the sake of games, and part of the cult of cricket is simply that cult of all those sports page things.
Well, I think that comment is as relevant as it ever was, because if you go on the Guardian website, for example, in England, you'll see the most popular stories of the football analysis, and some guy will write an opinion about something that's happened on the soccer field and all the players, and you'll get 700 comments. People, sport is still a very convenient way for people to enter into discussions of real importance, which they would not otherwise undertake. I mean, cheating. The question of steroids in baseball. I mean, these are all questions which are all essentially canvassed in Beyond a Boundary. The question of what is a true sportsman, and what are the values that a sports club must have, and what makes Rodriguez an appealing character in baseball, and Derek Jeter an appealing one. And people are it opens certain intellectual doors, it opens emotional doors, and I think that there's something unarguable about the degree to which sports, particularly with men, almost exclusively with men, I would suggest, seizes their imaginations and seizes their sort of their spirit. So you have to ask yourself, and I think he's quite right in this, what is it? What is it that's so significant about this element of culture? And why is it that it has not been given its due? I mean, it's given enormous amounts of money, it's given enormous amounts of coverage, but rarely in intellectual circles do people consider it with the degree of seriousness which, for example, James considers cricket.
Yeah, we give it time. We don't give it real importance, though. We don't admit its importance. James writes in Beyond a Boundary, he said that they who laid the intellectual foundations of the Western world were the most fanatical players and organizers of games the world has ever known.
Yeah.
It is important. It's an art, ultimately. It's a tremendous revealer of things we deeply want to know. Richard Reeves says with great sort of regret that what we've learned in American life since John F. Kennedy, what television told us was that we're more interested in football, American football, than we are in politics. But in cricket and in the commentary on it, and certainly in C.L.R. James and you, there is still a way of talking about the great players, Laurie Constantine or W.G. Grace above all, maybe the Babe Ruth of English cricket, and make it seem important. He said W.G. Grace was the most important figure in 19th century England, more important than Queen Victoria or anybody else. And you almost believe him.
Well, I mean, I think it's regrettable that in American sporting culture there is such a boundary placed between sports talk and political talk.
I mean, interesting.
It really is really odd. I mean, that boundary exists much less in Europe. And I remember just recently in the world of soccer, and there's been a slight sort of international incident or tension, I should say, between Manchester United and Real Madrid, because Real Madrid were trying to poach Cristiano Ronaldo from Manchester United, the greatest player in the world probably, with one possible exception. And they just succeeded in doing that this week. But Manchester United's manager, Alex Ferguson, has always said, he essentially hinted that he hates Real Madrid and loves Barcelona by contrast. And the reason for that being that he associates Real Madrid with Franco and the politics of Franco, obviously.
Interesting.
Whereas Ferguson himself comes from a blue-collar, working-class background. Talk about soccer, for example, in England is often complicated by talk about who owns the clubs and which part of society is best served by the game and all the rest of it. Whereas here, I mean, you look at someone like Tiger Woods, who's this kind of wandering emblem of American possibility, and almost no leakage between him and the world of corporate sponsorship and the wider culture, and it seems just seems odd.
I'm not sure what you mean. He is almost the same as corporate sponsorship. I mean, he's doing watches,
that's what I'm saying,
this and that and the other, but he doesn't leak at all into, I mean, who knows whether he's Republican or a Democrat.
He doesn't personally leak, which is, I suppose, his prerogative. But I just think that there are many ways into and out of various sporting, cultural, I should say, phenomena. You know, like, for example, this book of mine has been interpreted a million different ways, and that's fine. You know, likewise, golf is open, it seems to me, or cricket or football are open to all sorts of interpretations, on top of all the who's playing well and who's hooking the ball and who's having problems with their linebacker. There's that sort of technical discussion, which, of course, is valid and vital and fun. But it's only rarely that has been translated into the wider realms of the culture. And this is one of the great things which C.L.R. James achieves, is that he takes the sport and all the dramas and conflict of the sport and draws a line between them and essentially the ancient Greeks.
Yes.
And what do we learn from that? We learn not just about cricket, but we obviously learn about the roots of, our own way of looking at the world.
It's so interesting. He draws a political meaning, whereas could you draw a political meaning to the rivalry between the Red Sox and the Yankees? Provinces against the capital, people against money, or couldn't you?
Well, I mean, you could, but you don't want to be artificial about it either. I just don't know enough about the sort of the Yankees and the Red Sox. I mean, I do know that my son, who's 9 years old and grown up in New York, told me yesterday that the Red Sox are horrible. He hates them.
And I,
you know, this is a kid who's not even interested in baseball.
Is he an imperialist in general?
Well, I don't know. He's certainly a New Yorker, that's for sure. And and I think, you know, it's been a rather rough week for the Yankees fans.
8-0, son.
8-0 is not a very. It's a fairly conclusive result.
He's got guts to announce his loyalty at this point, but.
Well, you know, I think, you know, I think he knows he doesn't know any better.
Come back to the meanings of this game, as C.L.R. James writes them, as you write them in Netherland, and put them into the head or read the mind of Barack Obama, President of the United States, reading this book, he says, on his night table. To me, it's full of meanings, but I'm wondering what you think.
Well, I mean, I have a number of thoughts about this, as you can imagine.
Congratulations, incidentally, on making the presidential night table.
All right, thank you very much. Well, that's the first thought, is how weird it is that, you know, the distance between me and Barack Obama has suddenly collapsed. Well, at least it's collapsed to this extent. And the second thought is, before I come to the... And the second thought is that, you know, as a writer, you ought not to be too grateful for the blessings of power. You know... It's not you want to sort of, as it were, believe in your own in what you do, and you know, I always grew up thinking that writers, in particular, were as trustworthy and as interesting a repository of human wisdom, etc., as anyone, and therefore it seems to me entirely natural that a politician, even if he is the President of the United States, should seek to read a novel from time to time and derive the sort of complex gratification that you get from that. That it's my novel is obviously a source of great satisfaction to me, but that's the more general point. I would simply sort of defend the artist, not just the novelist, but the artist generally against the presumed gratitude which he or she should feel in the face of power. The other thought I have is, you know, in returning to more directly to your question, is you know, what is Obama, you know, seeing, how is he connecting to this book, and why would this book sort of connect to him? I don't know. I mean, I think it's presumptuous of me to sort of speculate about that. But just stepping back from it for a second, if this novel confronts the American reader with the other, namely cricket. That is something which would obviously appeal to this president, who is, it seems to me, extremely interested in the tension between oneself and the other, and sees it as a very fruitful tension. Or to put it another way, if there's any American who could understand cricket, it is Barack Obama.
Mm. That's,
and in fact, that's
very
his platform.
Well,
and in many ways, his platform is a Ramakrishnan platform.
Yes,
namely that the current boundaries, and this is again, you know, the reference to James is intentional. The current boundaries of American vision have proved to be defective. They just have, and the Bush years represented a kind of catastrophic shrinkage of the idea of what it means to be American and the idea of what the role of America in the wider world might be. And Barack Obama, for biographical and intellectual reasons, for autobiographical, I should say, and intellectual reasons, is in a position to make another argument. And I think so far he's made it rather persuasively.
That's a wonderful crack at it, but we could go on. It seems to me Barack Obama is very much a child of the C.L.R. James imagination, trying to think up what C.L.R. James found in cricket, which is to say an apparatus for reconciling power and poverty, black and white, the banker world and the starving world, in a framework that is open, that is competitive, that is fair, that is meritocratic, that roots, as C.L.R. James did. I mean, he was a champion above all of Toussaint Louverture and the Haitian Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
but equally of William Makepeace Thackeray and that novel Vanity Fair, which he virtually memorized, and to be working always in this tension, in a sophisticated tension that's reconciling things.
Well, I mean, you know, we don't want to get too abstruse about the whole thing, but one philosopher who was of great interest to James was Hegel. And in fact, when James was in America, he would scribble off these commentaries on Hegel, which he would then have sent to the Detroit car workers. One can only imagine how they were received. But anyhow, they were apparently well received. And again, one doesn't want to simplify Hegel too much. Not that I have that profound an understanding of him. But, you know, Hegel obviously was an advocate of the idea of, or not an advocate so much as a sort of deployer of the idea, or that, you know, you take the thesis and the antithesis and you come up with a synthesis and you thereby create new areas of knowledge and understanding. And Obama is someone who it seems to me, very attracted to this idea of constant synthesis. And this isn't sort of, and because he's so clever, and because he arrives at it from an idealistic starting point, it's not a kind of triangulation argument. It's not where you're triangulating political, opposing political forces in order to maximize your political power. It's that you take ideologies that are ostensibly in conflict, and in fact, not merely ostensibly, but substantively in conflict, and you try to bring them together in such a way as to produce something new. I mean, the most important example for me is, it's a small one, but, you know, Barack Obama is a black president, and he emerges, from one point of view, from the African-American world. But in fact, Barack Obama emerges from a completely different world, which is the world of Africa and the world of Kenya. And so that in order to make political progress for himself, he had to mobilize his African-American followers who are wedded to certain civil rights narratives, for example. And at the same time, he was able to mobilize people from outside that community because he proposed a different model of what it might mean to be, you know, black in America, and was able to embody that more than anything else. And so I think it's his own autobiographical reasons. His identity has been in a constant state of flux, and he has come to understand, I think, that flux, if you're attentive about it, can actually be very productive.
Yeah.
And James himself said that the greatest curse, and this is sort of a non-ideological point, but the greatest curse, you know, visited upon humanity was this sort of insistence on the part of the world to sort of categorize and limit people. And he loathed it. He loathed the kind of sort of way in which human beings were sort of reduced to specializations and categories. He really felt that, things were more complicated and more glorious than that.
Yeah. Joseph O'Neill, is it possible that in Netherland you've written the book for this age of Obama, and that you and C.L.R. James together in your different generations have found this sort of game and metaphor for the age of Obama?
Well, that isn't for me to say. That is not for me to say. I mean,
but are we on the right track here?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's undoubtedly true that this book, simply by virtue of the connection it's made, not simply to Obama, but to sort of various, you know, readers, is onto something in the zeitgeist. And, you know, I feel very lucky about that.
We feel very lucky to read it, honestly. It's a marvelous book. And I thank you for this conversation.
You're very welcome, Chris.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation with Joseph O'Neill. Our interns at Brown, Hannah Olson and Chantal Berman, helped us think it through. By all means, read this book, Netherland. And while you're up, check out Beyond Boundary by the late, great C.L.R. James. And then comment away on this global intersection of games, style, identity, power, and history at our site, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.